Lee, I'm going to tell y'all how bad Lee lies to me. He says, I don't even ask him anymore. I used to ask him, please do something with the video camera. I mean, that's just a little intimidating. He said, honey, I'm going to make you look like a Greek goddess. I'm like, man, that ship has so sailed. That ship has so sailed. My name is Robin Vernon, and I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon. Thanks for the invitation, Lee. I'm grateful to be here. Terry, Rachel, Cindy, whew. I'm amongst some strong, strong recovering women in this room. And it feels so good. I want to thank all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous in here for my program. I know where it comes from. Thank you. Thank you very much. I didn't feel that way in the beginning. But I certainly do feel that way today. You all are my family of choice. My family of choice. You are my tribe. And I don't take that lightly. When Lois Wilson, Bill's wife, co-founder of Al-Anon, was asked what she did in the moment of silence before the Serenity Prayer, she said she invited the God of her understanding to the meeting. So if we could have, before I get any trouble up here, I got to make my nest. Look, a free ring. Just kidding. I heard the announcement. Like I said, before I get in any trouble up here, I'm stealing jewelry already. If you all would join me in a moment of silence and invite the God of your understanding to the meeting, please. Amen. Thank you. My home group is the Help and Hope Al-Anon Family Group. We meet Saturdays at 5 p.m. in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We study the steps, traditions, and concepts. Yep. I think I could safely say most meetings our stools, legs are the proper height. By and large, we are a well-rounded group, and I am very grateful. Very, very grateful. I don't come from a family of origin that had an alcoholic in it. Matter of fact, my mom and dad were teetotalers. A good Southern Baptist family. And for anybody in here that's not aware of it, I want you to let you know right now, drinking is a sin. Dancing, yeah, that's true. We didn't do any dancing either. That's right. I didn't understand when I first came in Al-Anon that my family had been profoundly affected by the disease of alcoholism, because these are family secrets. I come from this big secret-keeping family. I knew about Cousin Roy Lee, who was pretty out and loud with his alcoholism. He actually died from terminal alcoholism. But I did not know that my mom and dad each had an alcoholic in their family of origin. And they go generations back, terminal alcoholism. So what that means is that I was affected by the family disease of alcoholism at birth. At birth. And, you know, my mom and dad did a lot more right than they did wrong. You know, and I know that today. But I suffer from the isms of alcoholism. And that's the internal spiritual malady. I never fit. I was never enough. I was always right, or could convince you thereof, but I always felt wrong. So I just never fit anywhere, less than. And I think that I like to blame my rebelliousness on that as well. I don't know that that's true. It might just be in my DNA. But, you know, when they told me drinking is a sin, man, I couldn't wait. And I've done a lot of dancing with you all on the other side of the hall. I gave it my best shot. But I just do not have the allergy. And honestly, I'm so grateful that I don't. Because I can't, as hard as it has been for me to stay in recovery, Al-Anon recovery, I can't imagine having that built-in stumbling block of allergy, you know, the allergy, the craving, the obsession. I can't imagine it. I came into Al-Anon because I was married to an alcoholic. And I want to tell you about our first date. David Vernon and I, we went through school together. I knew him from middle school. We saw one another in the principal's office. But we didn't have our first date till we were juniors in high school. He asked me out to a party. It's only about 3 miles from my house, a girl that we went to school with. We went to the party. I thought we had a great time. On the way home, he scared me to death. Driving. So we get in the driveway. I'm grateful to be there alive. And he says, "You want to do something tomorrow?" I said, "Yes." So here's your first, for anybody that's paying any attention at all, here's your first kind of flashing light. Uh-oh, danger, danger. And so the next day, he stood me up on our second date. Turns out he drove me home in a blackout. So he called me later that afternoon, not knowing he'd stood me up, and I cursed him out and hung up on him. And 15 minutes later, the doorbell rang, and there he stood, and he said, "You want to go to Tanglewood?" I said, "Yeah, let's go." So David and I fell in sick. Okay? We fell in sick. And you know, that can be a good thing for a short period of time. We were married at 23. And we were separated the first time at 29. And what happened, he had a great job at R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, which was the place to work in Winston-Salem, and he walked off the job. He just left and pretended to go to third shift work for 2 weeks, as I might add, till my mom came over and said, "David's lost his job." I said, "No, he's not." And she explained it to me, and I was more than a little unhappy. He immediately, super smart man, hard worker, and he immediately got another new job, and I went in the bathroom and found him drinking beer in the shower at 7 a.m. for his new job within like a couple of weeks. And for me, that's when the first warning bells sounded, and I did the only thing I knew how to do. I kicked him out of the house and changed the locks. If there are any new Al-Anons in here, I am not recommending that. But I didn't know anything about detaching, and so I did the only thing I knew how to do. I just removed the offending member. I amputated my husband. So I detached with anger. And, you know, he went through all of his friends and ended up with his family, and then they put him in treatment. He called me on his birthday from a treatment center, and he said, "I am exactly where I need to be." And that was weird. That was strange. It was different. And he said, would you like to come to the family program? And I said, well, what is that? And he said, well, that's where the family members go to recover, like we go to AA to recover. It's called Al-Anon. And I remember saying, recover what? I mean, I had only lost a drunken husband and I wasn't interested in recovering that. I didn't have a problem. He was the problem. There was absolutely nothing wrong with me. And it would be 9 years later, 9 years later that I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting, because I could justify and rationalize a huge amount of inappropriate behavior because I lived with an active alcoholic. So he came all the way in and sat all the way down, and he became a good, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a different human being. And over the period of, I think it was probably 2-3 years, I don't know. I don't do well with time frames and dates, but we reconciled, and we got a new house together, and we moved the house, and we spent a couple of years remodeling the house, and you know, we have something in Al-Anon called the 3 C's. I didn't cause it. I can't control it. I can't cure it. And when I heard those, I thought, well, I never thought I caused this thing. But I remember moving into that new house thinking, I'm going to cook dinner every night. I'm going to keep this house cleaner than I ever have. I've got a new job. I make more money. We have a walk-in closet. All my shoes are lined up on the shelf. And the subconscious thought after that was, and he won't have to drink. And he won't have to drink. So I sure enough thought I caused it subconsciously. I had proven to myself that I could not control it and I couldn't cure it. But I had a 4th C, and that was contribute. And I did a lot of contributing to the disease at my house. Most of it with my mouth and a lot of it with my attitude. I remember saying to him, why are you still hanging out with those people? Why are you still going to those meetings? You hadn't had a drink in over 5 years. He came home to an old idea every night. I had no idea that his very life depended on him hanging out with those people and going to those meetings. I was totally ignorant about the disease of alcoholism because there was nothing wrong with me but him. After 7 years of sobriety, he relapsed. He hurt his back and his family doctor hooked him up, and I came home from work and he was in a blackout. And that started some of the worst insanity, 2 years of the worst insanity I've ever lived in. And I can tell you I was probably 95% of it. My disease kicked in. If I had to use one word to describe it, it would be control. 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 And control of him. The alcoholic. That's what it was all about. That's what it was all about. I want to qualify myself just a little bit. I did a lot of search and find. A lot of search and find. He had a duffel bag in the basement and he just kept, he put stuff in there. I can tell you that I knew a lot more about what was in that duffel bag than he did because I searched it every day. Every single day. And then I would find it. I would run upstairs and I would, first thing was like, got you, busted. Don't you think for 1 second you're getting anything over on me, buddy. And then I would try to make him tell the truth. And you know how that worked. You know how you can tell if an active alcoholic is lying? Their lips are moving. That's right. Now today, I absolutely, positively understand that the active disease will go to any lengths to protect itself. It would not allow him to tell the truth. His lying didn't have anything to do with me. But we've heard a lot about selfishness and self-centeredness up here. I'm here to tell you, UAAs don't have the market on that, okay? He drank at me. He drank at me. He lied to punish me. It was all about me. Look at what he's doing to me. The Al-Anon salute. Martyrdom was one of those character defects I didn't have. We have something called the 5 M's. Managing, manipulating, meddling, martyring, and mothering. These are not things we need to be running around doing. Managing, manipulating, meddling, martyring, mothering. And I knew I wasn't martyring. Now I definitely wasn't mothering because I had another M for that, and that was murderous heart. Murderous heart. Yeah, about 90% of the time I wanted to take his life. Because remember, I didn't have a program. I didn't have any tools. And I was so angry, so angry. So his doctor was giving him a lot of prescription drugs. So I thought, well, I better just talk to this doctor. So I called the doctor and I explained it to him. David's got all these pills you're giving him in an unmarked Tylenol bottle. I don't know what he's taking or when, but he is crazy. And he said, thank you so much for calling and letting me know. I'll not be giving him any more medication. And it wouldn't even be a week that I would find another bunch of prescription drugs. And so then he didn't want to take my calls anymore. The doctor was, I don't know how many times he actually talked to me, because I'm pretty much in a whiteout at this point. You know, talk about driven. I was driven. And so I wrote him letters. Because, you know, if I explained it to him one more time, the insanity. If I do it one more time, this time he'll get it. Now, I think back, who do you think the doctor was, who do you think he thought was insane? In this equation, I'm sure he's going, oh my God, if I was married to that woman, I'd be having trouble sleeping. I would be having some headaches and some muscle spasms, anxiety. Yeah, yeah. So, I think probably the sickest thing that I did, I had started having some physical symptoms myself at this point. It was near the end and of this 2 years. And I was having some jaw pain. So I went to the dentist, got my teeth checked. He said, I think your teeth are fine, Robin. They look okay. Do you grind your teeth? No, I don't grind my teeth. And then I had some ear pain. So I went to my family care physician. And he checked, Robin, your ears look good. Do you think you grind your teeth? No, I don't grind my teeth. Back to the dentist, x-rays. I don't know how many times I went back and forth, but, you know, finally my family physician says, are you sure you don't grind? I do not grind my teeth. I was like a tightly wound clock spring. I remember clearly wanting to pull a kid across the counter at Taco Bell and beat her to death because they put onions on my burritos. You know, you got a little bit of spillover there. Could never compartmentalize that kind of rage. And so my family physician said, listen, I'm going to give you some Klonopin. And he did. And I got it filled. But I was not about to take it because there was nothing wrong with me. What I did with it, I put it in the medicine cabinet beside David's shaving cream so he had to see it every day when he shaved. and I counted it every day to make sure he wasn't taking it. Yeah. Some of us are sicker than others. And I'm some of the some. So, on December 29th of 1992, I ran out of good ideas. I ran out of good ideas, and I'm so grateful. If I'd had one more good idea, I'd be out there doing it. I wouldn't be up here. I wouldn't be up here. The only reason I remember the date is my daddy's birthday. I heard David down in the basement at 6 a.m. that morning in the trash can. But he wasn't in the trash. He was in the back corner of the basement in the bird seed, 30-gallon trash can full of bird seed. And I knew he wasn't feeding the birds at 6 a.m. But I did not run downstairs to search and find. I didn't do anything. I believe today that it was a God that I didn't know, didn't have, didn't understand, doing for me what I could not do for myself. And I waited, and later that afternoon, David passed out on the sofa. I went downstairs, lifted the lid, and there were a lot of little airplane vodka bottles in there, empty. I took one upstairs, sat down across the room from him, and very gently said his name to wake him. Now, in the past, if I went down and found something in that duffel bag at 3 a.m., and he was asleep in our bed, I was coming up those steps not in a gentle way. And I could tell you, I didn't know where he was sleeping, but I could guarantee where he wasn't sleeping that night. Because I was a rager. I was a rager. If you'd have been a fly on the wall at my house, you would have thought I was an active alcoholic. Because I was much crazier than he was. Absolutely insane. I held that empty bottle up and I said, David, I can't live like this anymore. And if you want help, I'll go and support you. And he chose to go into an outpatient treatment center. And I went to the family program. Now I want to be real clear on why I went. I went to be sure that he went. And I went to be sure that he heard what he needed to hear. They put us all in there together, the patients and the family members, the first week, six days, 4 hours a night. Oh my God, it was a squirrely bunch. And all the way home, I would tell him, first I would tell him what it was he should have heard that night. And then I would talk about him and them. I would talk, did you hear what she said? Did you hear what he did? Did you hear what they tried to do? Could you believe that? Talking about him and them, him and them, him and them. I don't get any better talking about him and them. Third night we were there, they'd given us these notebooks. And the counselor sitting right in front of me, the same guy's been in there for the first three nights or two nights. And he said, turn page 47 in your notebook. And I very promptly and perfectly turned to page 47 in my notebook because there was nothing wrong with me. And then I looked over and David was struggling. So I just reached over and helped him find page 47 in his notebook. And I looked up and that counselor was looking right at me. He was frozen. And when I saw the look on his face, I knew it was exactly the same look I had on my face on the way home when I was talking about how sick they were. She was. He was. Talking about him and them. And my mind opened just a crack. Again, I think a God I had no idea of doing for me what I could not do for myself. And I thought, gosh, I don't believe I'm okay. I don't think I'm okay. Coincidence that they loaded us in a van and took me to my first Al-Anon meeting that night? I think not. I fit there. For me, it was like coming home. They were talking about the secrets I'd been keeping for years. They talked about themselves, but they were describing me. I fit there. They understood, and I knew it on the deepest level I'd ever known anything. And so for the first time ever, I started following good orderly direction. And that was my God. Good orderly direction. And they said the more meetings you go to, the quicker you're going to feel better. I was going to a lot of meetings. They talked about, what's this recovery? What is recovery? It's in the steps. Well, how do you work the steps? You have to have a sponsor to work the steps. Well, what's a sponsor? A sponsor is someone you hear with your heart. Way over my head. Well, I said, well, I mean, is there any other way to pick one out? I mean, seriously, do they carry cards or, you know, I didn't know. And of course, then I decided that I was, yeah, there's only 12 of these steps. How hard can this be? I don't really need a sponsor. And it took me about 3 weeks to figure that. This is a different language. This is a different language. And so I asked a black belt Al-Anon that had 25 years to be my sponsor. And I will always, always be eternally grateful. And she was definitely a black belt. I'll never forget the first suggestion. You know, we heard a little bit about this. They don't tell you what to do. But they make very strong suggestions. And she said it would probably be a good idea if you didn't say anything to David that was judging, accusing, or blaming. Jab, okay. Judging, accusing, blaming. Is it judging, accusing, or blaming? I went home and I held everything up to that. Is it judging? Is it accusing? Is it blaming? All communication on my part ceased. And I did not know how distorted my thinking was until that happened. That was my first really big awareness. Everything I'd said to this man for years was judging him, accusing him, or blaming him. That's how distorted my thinking was. I thought everything that was wrong in my world was David's fault. And that was so far from the truth. So far from the truth. So I went back to her and I said, gosh, we got a communication problem now. What can I say? Let's approach it from that direction. And she said, you can say it if it's loving, true, and necessary. But it has to be all three. And man, I could get true and necessary, but remember, I had a murderous heart. There was no loving going on in that house, I can tell you. Because I was very angry, full of rage, and had no tools to deal with it. So she put me to work in the steps. I did the paperwork on 1 through 4. 5 was the one I was going to skip. I was never... She was like I looked at her kind of like a fairy princess. I mean, she wore silk and linens, and she was always dressed to the max and had heels on. I'm boots and jeans, okay? I'm boots and jeans. And so she was a fairy princess, and I thought, if I ever tell her everything about me, she'll just have to leave the program, you know? Here's another one, grandiosity, you know. That's another one I didn't think I had. But anyway, so I was going to skip 5. But I did start a 4-step, and I was doing on the 7 most painful events of my life. Okay, that's where I ended up. And I had started with that. But then I found this list of emotions. Well, the only one I had was anger. And rage. But we have a list, and I think it's actually an Alateen list. But anyway, I thought, okay, well, what I'll do is I've written all this down. So let me, every emotion I think I had for each of the most painful events, I'll write them down and see how, if, you know, I was working on a colored graft after about a month or two, but she kept asking, how are you coming on that four step? Good, good. A week later, she'd say, you still working on that four step? Yes, ma'am. I'm making good progress. Making good progress. I don't know how many times she asked me, but I made the mistake of telling her the truth. And I told her I'm stuck. Because I was all up in it. You know, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. That used to be my motto. And so she said, well, I think maybe you need to process. I hadn't heard that word. I said, yes, I think maybe I do. And she said, come over to the house this Saturday. We'll have lunch and then we'll process. I said, okay. So that Saturday, we were having lunch. And the phone rang, and I heard her tell another Al-Anon. Now, I'm going to have the ringer on the phone turned off this afternoon because I'm going to be taking a fifth step. And I said, I wonder who's coming to do a fifth step when I get finished processing. She tricked me. She tricked me. And I will forever be grateful that a woman that knew me 3 months, loved me enough to risk our relationship so that I might be able to stay in recovery, because I have since learned that if I don't do my work, I probably won't get to stay. That disease will jerk me up out of there in a skinny minute. And I'll never know what happened. Inch by inch, it's a cinch. David relapsed about 3 weeks later. And I'm going to tell you, it was touch and go. You know, I was having trouble going to meetings. Oh, it was not good. It was not good. So, first of all, I asked her, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And she said, you treat him like an honored guest in your home. And I said, come again? Beg your pardon? Because, you know, I'd done that first 5 steps, but very superficial in 3 months. Okay? She said, you treat him like an honored guest in your home. And finally, after about 3 or 4 days, she said, look, the elevator's going down and you're both on it, but the door's opening on every floor and you can choose recovery and step off. You may need to come to my house for a week in order to be okay. And I really didn't like the idea of that. I didn't know this woman, really. But I took that risk. And I'll always be grateful that she suggested that. David was, he was as bad as I had ever seen him. Turns out he was in a 5-day blackout. David was a white-collar alcoholic. He never missed work. The way it worked at our house, David got drunk, Robin missed work. Okay? I had 20 jobs my first 18 years out of high school. And some of them are still operating doing it wrong. Okay? That knowing best. So I stayed over at her house for a week. And I came home at the end of that week. And he wasn't drunk. But at that point, I had started to detach. I had started to make the transfer from my head to my heart. You know, that was a hard, hard thing for me. My first sponsor called me the Ice Princess. And she said, I was so afraid that you were just going to fracture before you began to thaw. And so I'm going to tell you about how I made the transfer on the first step. I don't. done such a good job on my first step that I had been given David the number of an AA sponsor I had picked out for him. His sponsor had a lake house that didn't even have a telephone. I knew you had to be able to get a hold of your sponsor 24/7, and he couldn't. So the number I was giving him just happened to be the number of my sponsor's husband. And the little information exchange was an ulterior motive for sure. He never made the call. Never made the call. So when he relapsed, before I was getting ready to leave my house, I knew he was bad. He is at that bottom I've heard them talk about. I'm going to give him that number one more time. And he'll get it. He'll make the call this time. So I wrote down Ray's number on a sticky note. I was standing beside my car in the basement garage. David was standing right there. And I handed him that note. I said, here's Ray's number. Call him. He can help you. And then I took one step, got in my car and left. And I was raging on the way over to her house. Look at what he's doing. Look at everything I've been doing. I'm going to 9 meetings a week, including open AA speaker meetings. I'm doing everything that I can do. And here he is drinking again. Like any of that had anything to do with what he was doing. About halfway over to her house, I looked down and that sticky note was on the bottom of my shoe. I was one step away from my car. It's like God took it out of his hand and stuck it on my shoe. And that's what it felt like. I was like, oh my God. And something my sponsor, I don't know how many times she'd said it to me, came out of my mouth, I'm not qualified to help him. I'm not qualified to help him. Only another alcoholic can help him. I got to do what I got to do to be okay. And I put down the magnifying glass that I'd been watching him with for years, like a bug. And I picked up a mirror. And I picked up a mirror, finally. So that's when I made the transfer on the first step. I want to talk about briefly about the transfer on the third step. I don't know how long I'd been in. I don't think it had been that long. It was within the first year. And I came in, parked the car, got out of it. David was down in the basement. I know I was halfway up the steps. I'm looking down at him. And my disease said, he's been drinking. My disease talks to me. I don't know about y'all. It talks to me. It said he's been drinking. And then it said, it's in the bird seed. And I don't know, it was my last big find maybe, you know, because my sponsor made it very clear that when I'm doing the search and find, I have lost my mental and emotional sobriety. Okay? I'm going over the fence in left field. Okay? So... She had always told me, too, before you act out your illness, you pick up that phone and you call me. You call me. So I ran upstairs, got the walk-in phone, went in the walk-in closet and closed both doors because that's where I always talk to my sponsor. And I said, he's been drinking. I can tell. You know I've partied with him enough that I can tell. And I just know it's in the bird seed and I need to go look. And she said, Robin, your higher power is going to let you know what you need to know when it's time for you to know it, see what you need to see when it's time for you to see it, and hear what you need to hear when it's time for you to hear it. And I knew better than to talk to her when she was in that black belt frame of mind. This was Thursday. I saw her at a meeting that night. I know I told her, talked about it again. She said, Robin, your higher power is going to let you know what you need to know when it's time for you to know it. See what you need to see when it's time for you to see it and hear what you need to hear when it's time for you to hear it. I don't know how many times she said that to me. I really don't. David worked as a starter at a golf course on Saturdays. That means you go out there at dark o'clock and you tell them when to go. Yeah, it's way early, way early. It was Saturday. I like to sleep in on Saturday. The phone rang way too early, and it was David. And he said, "Would you do me a favor?" I said, "What? Would you feed the birds for me?" And he proceeded to send me down to the bird seed trash can. Now, I need to tell, fifth step, I dug way deeper than I needed to feed the birds. There was nothing there. There was nothing there. Now, we've heard about trust. Third step, turn our will and life over to the care of God as we understood Him. Yeah. Now, you know, if I had gone on down in my active disease and searched that bird seed and found nothing, I don't know how long it would have taken me to do it. Probably not long. I'd had to fifth step my sponsor about it, and there's no telling what kind of homework that I would have gotten out of that. But the point is, man, God's plan and God's timing are perfect. 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 That was a gift. That was evidence. Evidence. Look for evidence. Evidence. God's fingerprints all over that. All over that. I want to talk about the last time David came home drunk to our home. It was November 22nd of 1993. Been about a year that I'd been in Al-Anon. Not quite. I cooked dinner. I don't know how that happened. I have no idea. We didn't have meals together. I didn't cook. You know, he was still active. I'm not well enough to spend extended periods of time around an active illness. I'm just not. I'm still not today, in all honesty. But he came home and I had dinner cooked. We sat down, we had a meal together. I have no idea what we talked about, but I can tell you what we didn't talk about. The fact that he'd been drinking. In the past, my mind would be hooked to the doorknob. I'd pray him all the way home. God, I promise, won't say anything. Won't judge, accuse, blame. Won't anything. And then as quick as he walked in, I would say something really smart like, "You've been drinking." And then he would start, these are our old tapes. This is what we said and did for years and years and years. And I would say, "Dave, I can tell when you've been drinking." But I said nothing. You all had taught me to ask to know when to speak up and when to shut up. And if it's time to speak up, that it be God's words. I was doing the dishes and that's what I was doing. That's what I was doing. I had learned that it was okay for me to state my truth. Not to make him do something or keep him from doing something, but because that's what I needed to do. And I turned around. He's sitting at the table. He's got this kind of deer in the headlights look because I'm doing something different. I'm doing something different. And I turned around and I said, "Dave, I need to let you know I'm uncomfortable with the way you are." And that's all that came out of my mouth. And he immediately started his part. "Well, I've not been drinking." I said, "Stop. I can't discuss it with you. I just need to let you know how I felt." Finished the dishes and went and sat down on the sofa, because I had an 8 o'clock meeting and I just could not wait. About 30 minutes later, he came in, he sat down beside me. He said, "I drank today. I've hurt you. I'm sorry." As soon as I stopped trying to tell him, make him tell the truth, what does he do? He comes right in and tells the truth. God's plan and His timing are perfect. I'm going to tell you what happened for me in that moment. I looked in his eyes, and for the first time in all the years we'd been together, I saw how badly his drinking hurt him. It had always been about me. It had always been about me. I was blown away. I know nothing about the pain of the disease of alcoholism. And I told him, David, I love you and I want you to be okay, but I can't help you. You know where your help is. And I left and I went to my meeting. 2 years later, I went to the same open AA meeting that I've been going to since I came in. Guess who the speaker was? It was David Vernon. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, when I came home November 22nd of 1993 and my wife didn't go crazy like she always had in the past, I didn't have anything else to look at but me. And I did not like what I saw. That was his sobriety date. And I look back on that, and the visual that I have is I'm standing over him with my hands on my hip, doing that Al-Anon handshake. And his higher power is behind me, just tapping me on the shoulder ever so gently. And he's saying, excuse me, excuse me. That young man needs my help. And if you'll step aside and stop playing God, I'll help him. And I'm like, oh, no, 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 God. You help someone that doesn't have someone like me to help them. That God-like attitude, knowing best. Ah, the biggest difference between me and God, he never thinks he's me. He doesn't get confused about that. I still occasionally get confused. David and I had about 6 or 7 years together in recovery. And then it was obvious to both of us that we didn't need to be married. And we divorced in recovery. We handled ourselves in a recovery way. We treated each other like we wanted to be treated, talked to each other like we wanted to be talked to. We dated after we were divorced. Only the very sickest ones do that. And that just reaffirmed that we didn't need to be together in that way. He was my best friend. He was my soulmate. He was a big shot. He would call me every day on his, every year on his sobriety date, and he would thank me. He's a big fan of Al-Anon. And then he would say, but just remember, you wouldn't have got here without me. In 2009, David called me from another treatment center. He was just a couple months short of 16 years. And that's when I began to learn about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. How truly baffling, cunning, powerful, and patient the disease of alcoholism is. treated him like an honored guest. We would go out and we would have dinner and we would shoot pool. We had always done that. But when I didn't hear from him, I knew he was back out. And everything that comes along with relapse came along. He suffered consequences that he'd never suffered before. And every time I talked to him, I said, "Dave, you're a good man. You deserve the very best that God has to offer. I love you." He called me one time drinking. I said, "Honey, I can't talk to you when you're drinking. Let's pray." And I prayed and he wept. It was so very ugly. So very ugly. You've seen it. You all have seen it. You know what I'm saying. September of 2011, he came by the house. And he had been ravaged by the disease. And he told me, "I don't think I'm going to live through another relapse." I said, "David, you're a good man. You deserve the very best that God has to offer. I don't want you to die. I love you." And a month later, October 2011, a dual member from my home group called to let me know that David had died from the terminal effects of alcoholism. Now, the miracle in all of that for me is that I took no more dignity from a fine man. He knew how I felt about him. He knew that I loved him very deeply. And he suffers no more. He suffers no more. If I had not been given the tools of recovery in Al-Anon that allowed me to love him from a distance when I needed to, and my disease would say, "It'd be okay for you to drive by his house. It would be okay for you to call him." Every fiber of my being wanted to do something. Wanted to do something. But I knew I'm not qualified to help him. So I want to tell you about my last, I retired in 2019, worked at a dermatology office. I was a Mohs histotech, a medical assistant, OSHA coordinator, and infection control coordinator. And I want to tell you about my last review by the owner of the practice. It was a very positive review. It was probably one of the best reviews I've ever gotten. But there was a statement in it that said, "I would like to see Robin be less officious with the other medical assistants." I'd never heard that word. So I Googled it. And the first definition was meddlesome. Now remember, managing, manipulating, meddling, martyring, mothering. Meddlesome. The second definition was offering unsolicited advice. Anything worth doing is worth overdoing. The journey continues. Letting go on a deeper level. you know. I just hear like a mantra, keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back. I want to tell you about the plumber. It's not going to be what you think, I can tell you that. So on a Sunday, I got a leak in my main sewer line in my basement. This is not a problem you can ignore. And it was a Sunday, and I thought, man, this one's not going to be cheap. But I called, and a nice man came out, and he looked at the problem. He went to Lowe's. He came back. He fixed it. He cleaned up after himself. He said, let me check your septic tank and your pumping station. I was like, oh, God, this one is going to cost. He checked the septic tank, the pumping station. You know, he was around. And so finally it was time for him to leave, and I was standing out by the van, and I said, well, how much do I owe you? How much do I owe you? He said, you were married to David Vernon, weren't you? And I said, yes, I was. He said, you were David's Robin. I was like, yes, I was. And he said, David Vernon saved my cousin's life. He's still sober today. There'll be no charge for you today. And you know, those kind of things have happened more than once. I have people, I have no idea who they are, that come up and say, are you David's Robin? You know, I don't even want to know how he talked about me in the meeting. But he knew that Al-Anon had helped him attain sobriety. Because it helped me get out of God's way. Stop playing God and get out of God's way. You know, I can't tell the difference between a tragedy and a miracle. I don't know the difference between a tragedy and a miracle. I would have told you it was a tragedy I married an alcoholic. But that's my miracle. Because I needed this program long before I ever laid eyes on David. So the way I look at my life today is my worst day today. Worst day is 300% better than my best day used to be pre-Al-Anon. And that just tells me I'm right where I need to be. I'm with my family of choice, and I'm doing what I need to do. Thank you. I love you.